Hi there. I know you're about to listen to a program from RN, which is great, but why not try the All in the Mind podcast too? I'm Lynne Malcolm, and All in the Mind is a show about the brain, the mind, and our endlessly fascinating behaviour. You can find out more about it and download the podcast from the RN website.
Good morning and welcome to Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart. It's very nice to be with you this morning here on RN. Today, the striking works produced by the vast art factory of Mansudae in North Korea and how its propaganda artists have brought a charming German fountain back to life. And we head to MoNA, the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, for a fresh take on Lewis Carroll. But first, a really special novel, straight from the childhood of a very popular English writer. Well, I'm not sure whether this is a book for children, but I know it's a book for adults who can still remember, however dimly, what it feels like to be a child, to live in a child's world of magic and wonder and dark fears. It's a sinister and magical tale called The Ocean at the End of the Lane, and it's written by the fabulous Neil Gaiman, whose award-winning fiction includes The Sandman comics, Neverwhere, Coraline, and The Graveyard Book, and two episodes of Doctor Who. And Neil's on the phone now from the United Kingdom. Neil, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So this is an unnerving cosmos that you take us into in this story. Can you just describe the lay of the land for us?
Well, the lay of the land is we begin with a middle-aged man leaving a funeral, going down to the farm at the end of the road that he lived on as a child. And sitting in front of a duck pond, he remembers things that happened to him when he was seven. Very strange, peculiar things that begin when the family's lodger steals their car and drives it down to the end of the lane and commits suicide. And that proves the beginning of weirdness. He makes friends with the family at the end of the lane, who are three strange, wonderful, possibly ageless women.
The Hempstock ladies.
The Hempstock ladies. And he also winds up accidentally bringing back into his life something that calls itself Ursula Monkton, which is rather like, I suppose, what Mary Poppins would have been like if she was absolutely 100% dangerous, nasty, and no fun at all.
So Ursula Monkton is a sort of nanny from a dark dimension. And I'm not sure whether she really means to do harm, but she turns the little boy's life into an absolute misery. In fact, well, he ends up in a fairly serious battle with her, and she seduces their father. I mean, this is a rebellious boy, isn't he? He doesn't do what his father tells him to. In fact, his father has been stripped of all moral authority by the story, really.
I definitely don't think it's a book about rebellion. I think it's a book about survival, which is a different kind of thing. And yes, his father is stripped of moral authority, but I'm not sure that there are any people in it, including our protagonist, who come out of it terribly well, with the possible exception of the Hempstocks. And they are sort of strange and magical and privileged.
They have a sense of timelessness. They were there at the very beginning.
It was actually really fun writing them. The youngest of them, Letty Hempstock, who becomes our hero's friend, is 11. As our protagonist asks her at one point, he says, well, you've been 11, haven't you, for a very long time? And she has. And she says that the Hempstocks came to Hempstock Farm, or they came to that part of the world, and they crossed the ocean, and for her, the ocean is her duck pond. And her mother says that, of course, she's very silly, and she doesn't even remember the old country they came from because that sank beneath the waves. And old Mrs. Hempstock, her grandmother, says they're both very silly, and she's the one that can remember the really old country, and that blew up. But then old Mrs. Hempstock says she can remember the Big Bang, and she knows when the moon arrived.
She's been around for a while. It's very hard to talk about this book because normally when you interview an author, you don't want to give away the ending. But I don't want to give away any of it.
I saw what I think is right now my favourite book review of any of my books ever. And I've been, you know, I've been writing for 30 years, and they've been reviewing me for almost that. In the Minneapolis Star Tribune this week online, and somebody managed to put up a review in which they told absolutely nothing about the plot of the book at all, and just talked about the experience of reading it, what it made them think of, what it reminded them of. And I thought, that's absolutely fascinating. There's somebody who is so determined not to spoil the book for anybody, to spoil anything. They just want to talk about why they loved it and why how it made them feel and how you should please go out and buy it, which I liked that bit also as an author.
Well, as you would, yes. Well, oddly, it's terribly enjoyable, although it's terribly menacing as well. This is a book in which the child protagonist could die, you feel. You have taken us to places like this before in your graphic novels, in Violent Cases and Mr. Punch, you know, places where children are betrayed by adults, where adults can be violent, and it is the child who is grappling to preserve a sense of safety and maybe of moral order in the cruel reality of the adult world.
So I really have. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me right now is where people are saying, well, this book, you know, comes completely out of nowhere. It's nothing like any of your other books. And I go, actually, it's an awful lot like Violent Cases, which was 1986, and Mr. Punch, which was about 1995. But they were graphic novels and you didn't notice.
Mm. Well, they're saying that because they think of you as being more playful than this, aren't they?
And the funny thing is, in this book, which is probably the darkest thing I've ever done, there are lots of places where I do get to be playful. But they're odd little places, not just things like the Hempstock ladies talking about science and the universe. But there are points in the book where I got to invent other books. Our hero is very bookish. He's a seven-year-old who more or less lives when he can in books. And when I started writing it, I thought, well, I'll just talk about the kinds of books, you know, he would have read. And then I thought, well, I'm going to need to quote from books at some point. And I thought, well, it's actually more fun for me and so much less complicated for my publisher's legal department if I make up the books that he's quoting from. So I actually got to write paragraphs here and there from 1930s girls' school books that belong to his mum, of the kind, and plot the kind of girls' school books that I used to read that belong to my mum.
I'm ashamed to tell you, Neil, that I Googled some of those quotations to try to work out where they came from, and then I thought, oh, I see.
So did my publisher, and they came to me and they said, do we have to get permissions on these? And I said, nope, that's just me pretending to be Angela Brazil.
No, you did awfully well. In some ways, it's a book about women, I reckon. I mean, there is the boy who's the central character, but he's caught on the one hand between the thing that calls itself Ursula Monckton and the three generations of the ageless Hempstock family. I mean, it is a world in which women are at the heart of things and men are sort of peripheral, really.
I was fascinated by that. I think in some ways this book is probably more explicable if I tell you how it came about and then how I got there, which is... it was all the fault of my wife, Amanda Palmer, going to Melbourne for 4 months. She went to make a record in Melbourne in the beginning of 2012. She did a little tour with her band, the Dresden Dolls, and then settled down to make a record. And I was back in America, and I really missed her. And I decided I'd write a short story for her. And I thought, well, if I'm writing a short story for Amanda, I need to put in the kind of things that Amanda likes, because she doesn't really like fantasy and science fiction and adventure, but she likes personal stuff, she likes human stuff, she likes me. I'll tell her, you know, I'll do her a story that's sort of, you know, not actually stuff that happened, but what it was like to look out the world through my eyes when I was seven. And that was where I began. And I think partly because it was essentially, in its own very peculiar way, a love letter to a woman, The female energy became incredibly important when writing the book. And I also started looking back at what was important to me when I was seven. What made me feel comfortable? What gave me that sense of security? And a lot of it was my grandmother's. You know, when I go to my grandmother's houses, you know, being in their kitchens, and my grandmothers were very, very different. One of them was, you know, very fat and loving, and one of them was snippy and snarky but incredibly funny, and they were both magnificent cooks, and for both of them, food was love. So I thought, oh, I'll try and get that interesting feeling in there of essentially food being love and home and warmth. Once I had that, and that came in more or less from the very beginning with the Hempstocks, there was just this fantastic feeling of, okay, they are real. They became somebody very, very special. And having the Hempstocks as my protagonist somehow gave me permission to have easily the most monstrous and terrible female villain I've ever created, even though she may be doing good. And you know, I created Coraline's other mother as a baddie in the thing that calls itself Ursula Monckton.
Well, there's lots there I'd like to ask you about. We're talking to Neil Gaiman here on Books and Arts Daily about his new book. It's a book that I've absolutely enjoyed. It's called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. The ocean is actually a duck pond. Or maybe it's a duck pond. It looks like a duck pond, but it's actually an ocean. Anyway, you'll have to read the book to work out what that's all about. Now, several things that you raised. The first is that the fact that you were missing your wife and that she was in Australia explains to me why Australia feels so very far away. It makes an appearance at the very end of the book. Ginny Hempstock refers to Australia as if it's on the far side of the known universe and almost impossible for a person from Sussex to get there.
Well, I liked the idea that if you're 7 years old, being told someone's gone to Australia is absolutely, you know, especially in the days before Skype and in the days before you could phone anybody or anything. You know, when you're told somebody's gone to Australia, which happened to me a few times as a child. They had gone to the edge of the known universe. They might as well have gone to the dark side of the moon or to Jupiter, because they were gone. You had to wait till they came back.
Those were the days when people in England talked about going out to Australia.
They did. I remember that.
As if Australia were terribly, terribly far away. I remember saying to an Oxford academic who still used the expression going out to Australia, I said, well, that is a very imperial way to talk. I mean, I wouldn't talk about going out to England. She said, no. the other thing I know about you is that you yourself lived in West Sussex when you were a little boy.
It's interesting. I should probably clarify and say, well, the family is not my family. In that the landscape is absolutely the landscape of my childhood, which also was something that I wanted to give to Amanda, because when I tried taking her to the places that I grew up, they weren't there anymore. Mm. People have built housing estates and such all over them. It was a sort of an exercise in recreation for me. Any landscape, anything that I talk about there that's natural, actually did exist, from the azalea bushes to the fairy ring. I moved the location. I swapped two farms around and actually moved the duck pond slightly. But anything physical that's described really did exist. There's a drain pipe that at one point our seven-year-old climbs down. And he climbs down because he's read a lot of books. And because he's read books and people go up and down drain pipes in them, he's learned how to climb this big old iron drain pipe. And that drain pipe existed, you know. And after I'd written the book, I sent it to my sisters to read. One of them sent me back a photograph of me standing on the drain pipe.
Oh, how lovely. Did your family have a white mini?
They did. And actually, the awful story that begins the book is sort of true-ish. It's true-ish insofar as in 2003, when I was talking to my dad about the mini that I had just bought. And I said to him, you know, what if I happened to that lovely little white mini we had? He said, ah, you never knew about that. Well, and he told me that, you know, at some point in late 67, early 68, we had a lodger who came in from South Africa, blew all his money and all the money he'd been given by friends to take out of South Africa in the casino in Brighton, and stole our car, took it down to the end of the lane and committed suicide. And I remember my reaction when he told me this wasn't one of, oh my God, there was a tragedy that happened that I didn't know anything about. It was much more, what, there was something really interesting that happened when I was a kid. And I never knew. This thing happened. I was the kind of kid who would read books and think, why doesn't anything like that ever happen in real life?
One implication of the book is that money is what kills off the life of magic.
I think money runs all the way through the book, and it definitely is something that can kill off magic. But also I think the money runs through the book because money is incredibly important when you're a little kid, because you can't get it. It has this peculiar magical quality to it. Adults have it, mysteriously. And then adults sometimes have problems with it. One of the first things that happens in the book is our narrator loses his bedroom because the family doesn't have as much money anymore, and now they're taking in lodgers.
The book opens with a quotation from the writers, the children's writer Maurice Sendak, who wrote and drew Where the Wild Things Are. He said this: I remember my own childhood vividly. I knew terrible things, but I knew I mustn't let adults know I knew. It would scare them.
Almost immediately after I wrote the book, Maurice Sendak died. And I mentioned online that one of the things that I'd loved was a 1992-93 interview that Art Spiegelman, who created Mouse, had done with Sendak in the form of a comic. And somebody at the New Yorker read this on Twitter, and they reposted it. They put it back up online so you could see it as a tribute to Sendak. And I read it through when I got to that last line, where he talks about knowing terrible things adults shouldn't know, but not daring to tell them because it would scare them. And I thought, not only that is my book, but I also thought, that, I remember feeling like that. And I don't even remember now, really, what the things were that would have scared adults. But I remember the feeling of having a tremendous weight of responsibility, because as a kid, I could watch adults fooling themselves. I could watch a certain amount of the adult world and just know that I was above it. I was not part of it. I was like somebody in occupied territory. You know, the occupying forces were huge giants with immense amounts of power and control, but they could not break our spirits.
In our house, we had a very big cupboard that you could walk inside. And when I was little, we used to call it the tunnel. And I knew that the back of the cupboard was false and that, you know, you could open up that and it would take you to terrifying places. They weren't good places, but they were there behind this tunnel.
And, of course, you know, the strangest thing for me as a writer is every now and again going to the equivalent of your tunnel. And I actually do get to pull aside the back of that wall and creep behind it.
Neil Gaiman's my guest here on Books and Arts Daily, and we're talking about his new book, his wonderful new book, which is called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. I suppose another character who goes through the screen at the end of the tunnel is Alice, as in Alice in Wonderland, and there are several references to Alice. When did you first encounter her?
I first remember encountering Alice about the age that I would have been when I wrote this book. I would have been 7. It's pretty odd. I think we were read Alice at school by one of my teachers. And then we were assigned poems to try and memorize by heart. So I wound up learning at that age a lot of poems from Alice. And I actually put one of them into the book. There's a point where terrible, menacing things are happening to our protagonist. And one of the ways he's getting through it is by just sort of reciting everything he knows by heart. I had enormous fun doing that. And also, things in this book tend to go in threes. Sometimes the third thing is a little bit harder to find. And I love the idea that there would be three bodies of water in it. And one of them is very obvious. It's the ocean, which is the duck pond. One of them is a little bit more problematic when we encounter it, which is a bathtub filled with water. And I thought, I wanted another just to be implied. And I thought, well, in Alice, there is a pool of tears. And so you get some references in there to the Alice in Wonderland pool of Alice's tears.
Do you have a strong sense of the difference between Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass?
Yes. Alice Through the Looking Glass is cleverer and works on a sort of more intellectual basis for me. Alice in Wonderland is all heart and gut and weirdness, and you sort of get swept through it. And it doesn't quite make sense. It genuinely feels dreamlike. Alice Through the Looking Glass is brilliant, but you definitely feel that you're revisiting a place or visiting a place with Alice, and what you're getting is somebody very, very clever telling you some very, very clever things.
It's interesting because I think of Alistair of the Looking Glass as a rather bitter book, the work of a man who is not at all happy in himself or his place in the world, whereas Alice in Wonderland feels to me to be a book written in innocence.
I would agree. I think, Alice in Wonderland has that wonderful feeling of being somewhere on a summer's day and genuinely just telling a story to entertain some little girls that you're with and you're having a fantastic day. Whereas I don't know that Through the Looking Glass is bitter in the same way, but I do feel like it's actually somebody sitting down and going, I'm creating on the page. I'm not making up things now to entertain people on a beautiful summer's day, and anyway, those girls have grown up. So now I'm just telling a story, and here will be beautiful chess things, and here will be my fascination with language, and here will be my thoughts as an Oxford Don about the relationship between people and the other sides of mirrors. I will put all this in.
Well, lots to talk about there, but I don't want to let you go without asking about Doctor Who, because you've written two episodes of Doctor Who, and I'm a big fan of Doctor Who. Matt Smith's time is up as the Doctor, and I note that the venerable British actor Helen Mirren has said it's time we had a female Doctor. Do you reckon that would work? Could we have a female Doctor?
You're talking to somebody who actually, in my first episode, The Doctor's Wife, they let me sneak in a line which made it now canonical that Time Lords can change gender when they regenerate sometimes, which I did partly because that seemed to make sense to me, and partly because I thought, well, it'll be fun. Every time we cast a new Doctor Who from now on, we can argue about twice as many candidates in the pub.
You got an award for that episode, so it's got some kind of endorsement, the idea.
Exactly. I would love to see a lady Doctor at some point, because I think it would work brilliantly. I think what's interesting about the character of the Doctor is the character of the Doctor is all about exploration, all about interest, all about fascination, all about being glorious and strange and quirky, and it's not anything to do with actually possessing a penis, which we don't know if he has.
We don't. He's got two hearts, but we don't know if he's got a penis. What an edifying line to end on. Neil Gaiman, thank you for being my guest. It's been lovely to talk.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Neil Gaiman, his book is called The Ocean at the End of the Lane. It's published by Headline. Oh, Neil, perhaps we should go out with some music by your wife. What could we play since you wrote the book for her?
Well, why don't we play something from the album that she was making while I was writing the book? It's an an album called Theatre is Evil. And we could take one of the saddest songs, possibly, the Bed Song.
Here's Amanda Palmer and the Grand Theft Orchestra with the Bed Song from their album Theatre is Evil.
Exhibit A, we are friends in a sleeping bag, splitting the heat. We have one filthy pillow to share, and your lips are in my hair. Someone upstairs has a rat that we laughed at, and people are drinking and singing Van Halen and Slayer on a ukulele tear. Exhibit B, well, we found an apartment. It's not much to look at, a futon on a floor, torn off desktop for a door. All the decor's made of milk crates and duct tape, and if we have sex, they can hear us through the floor. But we don't do that. So I took the bed sheet, but I would have held you if you'd only let me.
Oh, on RN, Amanda Palmer with The Bed Song. And now on Books and Arts Daily to a very different sound. Imagine a row of female singers wearing very smart military uniforms with a glow of patriotic optimism on their upturned faces as we discover the art of North Korea. Yes, the sounds of North Korea. Well, the socialist realist style of art developed in the Soviet Union under Stalin and picked up by other communist countries looks, well, almost retro to the Western eye, doesn't it? You know those heroic statues of Stalin or smiling Chinese workers with their fists in the air? These days it's so kitsch that socialist realist medals and poster art have become kind of hip in the West. But socialist realism is still a very serious matter inside North Korea. The vast Mansudae art factory in the capital Pyongyang employs thousands of people, and they churn out heroic sculptures, paintings, murals and billboards deifying the three leaders of Korea's Kim dynasty, Kim Il-sung, Kim Jong-il, and the current supreme leader, Kim Jong-un. Now, Mansudae is accepting orders these days from other countries, and these commissions are worth millions of dollars. Bloomberg Businessweek journalist Carolina Winter has written about this colossal art factory, and she joins us now by phone from New York. Hello, Carolina. When did you first hear about the Mansudae art factory?
Well, I kind of stumbled upon it. I was looking through German news sites and came upon a mention of a enormous North Korean art factory that built things for other countries. And I actually couldn't access that article, but it piqued my curiosity. And so I started digging around and found that there wasn't all too much written about it in English language publications. So that's really how I decided to do this.
So where is it?
It's in North Korea's capital city, Pyongyang, and it's an enormous factory. It's on about 30 acres. The factory claims to employ about 4,000 North Koreans, including some 1,000 artists. And those artists are really handpicked from the country's best academies. They're kind of an elite group, the only people who are allowed to create artworks kind of in the image of the Kim family dynasty.
And some of the artwork that's available online is extraordinary.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's definitely, these are talented artists, a lot of them.
So when was this founded, this factory?
It was founded back in the 50s, and, the purpose was really to create art kind of glorifying North Korea. North Korea, actually, although it's an incredibly poor country, they spend a lot of their money on Kim family deification and kind of self-celebration.
Do we know what percentage of its budget that it spends on this deification of the Kims?
Well, it's very hard to know for sure anything about North Korea, but recently the Supreme People's Assembly of North Korea stated that they spent 44.8% of the total state budgetary for the economic development and improvement of people's living standards on just building edifices for the 100th birth anniversary of Kim Il-sung.
So if it's founded in the 50s, I think in 1959, this is when Kim Il-sung was president, the first of this line. I mean, he's president for this extraordinary period from 1948 right through until 1994. It's an incredible period. And this is really where the North Korean aesthetic, based on this Soviet model that we call socialist realism, is forged, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, it's definitely an aesthetic that would strike a lot of Westerners as very kitschy. I mean, it's definitely portraying North Korea as this utopia with apple-cheeked children and loving mothers, and Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-il are often portrayed as, you know, these smiling, benevolent patriarchs. So,
With very white teeth.
With very white teeth, indeed.
Yes, there's a nice distinction here between socialist realism and social realism. So social realism is the kind of art that depicts plain-speaking people, ordinary folks. So if you think of American Gothic, that famous painting of the guy with a pitchfork and his simple wife, he's a simple guy too, in front
right.
of simple architecture, that's what we call social realism. Socialist realism is this heroic veneration of the state and of state leaders that comes out of the communist countries. People, and we all do, we all muddle them up all the time. Now, what range of work does it produce? It doesn't just do paintings. It does all sorts of things, this factory.
All sorts of things. They're producing mosaics, embroidery, ceramics, billboards, murals, statues, you name it. I mean, it's an enormous factory. They're also making their own paints, and there's a paper mill on site, and so they've really got it covered.
This is Books and Arts Daily, and we're talking to Bloomberg Businessweek's journalist Carolina Winter, who's written this study or this report about the Mansudae Art Factory inside North Korea. Now, one of the things that's come out of this is that there have been some visits by outsiders to this factory. People from Germany have been wending their way to the factory. Tell us about that.
A number of people have visited this factory, and even tourists sometimes get to see it. It's one of the landmarks. But I was lucky to stumble upon some Germans a curator and art historian from Frankfurt who actually employed Mansudae Art Studio to recreate a fountain, this Art Nouveau fountain from Frankfurt that was destroyed during World War II. And they hired these artists to do that in 2005.
So it's called the Fairy Tale Fountain, and they had old photographs of this fountain. It's a classic. What style is it? I suppose it's sort of Art Nouveau, and there's this sort of allegorical figure at the top and a big fountain underneath and figures around it. It's simple and sort of charming work. So how did it turn out, these makers of propaganda turning their skills to make something so charming?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the reason the Germans, Klaus Klemp, who's deputy director of Frankfurt's Museum of Applied Art now, he's the one who really who found Mansudae Art Studio, and he told me that the reason that he hired them was because they're still making realist art, and in Germany it's very difficult to find really top-notch artists who are making realist art at this point. Most of the top artists have moved on to abstraction and modern art. And so the North Koreans are kind of frozen in time, and of course they produce art for much less money as well. So they found the job and they were very satisfied with the work. They did have to make some modifications, though, to kind of the initial cast. It was kind of rendered with a little bit of this heroic, angular socialist look initially.
Yes, her hair was a little bit severe.
That's right. Yeah, he said that the woman's hair kind of looked like a cement block.
Yes, they needed the sort of flowing, romantic look, and they hadn't quite captured
exactly.
that. Yeah. Now, it's not only the Germans who've been dealing with the Mansudae Art Factory in North Korea. Other countries have lined up to get the benefit of their skills. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, that is actually the bulk of Mansudae Art Studio's commissions come from African countries. And the most famous work that they created is a huge sculpture in Senegal. It is 164 feet tall, taller than the Statue of Liberty, taller than Christ the Redeemer statue in Brazil. And it is it's called the African Renaissance Monument. And it depicts a family, a father, mother, and child.
But there was a problem with that statue, too.
Yes, the faces initially looked Asian, which, of course, is not exactly what you want for an African Renaissance.
No, they were supposed to be an African family, and they looked a little bit Korean, which is a great thing. I looked at this online as well, and I've written here in the margin, just awful. I mean, the statue is just awful. It's gigantic, and it's this heroic, huge-chested male striding manfully towards the future. I think he's got the child in his arms, and he's got a very diminutive wife behind him. And it totally looks like a socialist realist vision of workers striding towards the future and celebrating the African Renaissance in Senegal.
Absolutely. And one thing that the Senegalese complained about also is that the woman is very scantily clad. She is this very busty woman wearing just a wisp of fabric. And, of course, Senegal is a majority Muslim country.
Yeah, she's a little bit allegorical, isn't she? Scantily allegorical.
Yes,
and, I mean, there are questions to be asked about this because you've got these African countries, many of them not terribly democratic, are building these great monuments in a style that is forged on a totalitarian template.
Yeah, absolutely, and there have been a lot of complaints that leaders are, you know, wasting money on these self-promotional projects. In Senegal, there were many. The labor unions really complained also that they were hiring the North Koreans to build this huge project at a time when unemployment in Senegal was estimated to be close to 50%.
And also using a style of art that doesn't seem to resonate with any kind of African cultural reference at all.
Exactly. No, there is absolutely no African. It's hard to know exactly what the leaders have in mind. I mean, perhaps they're trying to go for that same strong leadership look.
Yes, it's that bleak totalitarian style that just seems
that's right.
Devoid
but
of humanity.
But it is odd, isn't it? Does not fit in.
Yeah. So why are the African leaders drawing on this work? Is it just the style they like, or is the price attractive as well?
Well, the price is definitely attractive. It's difficult to get, you know, absolute figures for these statues, but President Wade in Senegal, he said that, you know, the North Koreans were the only country, or the only sculptors who he could afford. And a number of other leaders have said the same thing. I mean, to put perspective on it, the fountain that was built for Germany cost only 200,000 euros, all costs included, shipping, travel costs, everything.
Yes, and when you look at it, you'd have to think it's a multi-million dollar project, which suggests that these thousand artists, these highly skilled artists they've got there working, are not being paid all that much. Do we know?
Well, we definitely don't know. I think that the artists who are in Pyongyang, I've read that their lives are not all too bad by North Korean standards. They even, you know, they have a medical clinic and a sauna and a soccer field on the site of this enormous art factory. But the workers who are sent abroad to build the monuments, they're also probably being paid an okay wage by North Korean standards. In general, experts say that just any overseas position is considered a plum position in North Korea. Often people will pay bribes to go abroad. And that said, they're living in under strict surveillance most of the time. They're in dorms. There were local press accounts of people, you know, these North Korean workers living behind walls. Nobody ever really saw them. And so they are, you know, they have a chance to get out of North Korea. Most of the time they're eating regularly and making, you know, somewhat better wages than most North Koreans.
So the socialist realist style is alive and well.
Exactly.
Carolina, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Carolina Winter is a journalist with Bloomberg Businessweek, and you can find a link to her very fascinating article on North Korea's massive art factory. It's called Mansudae, and you'll find that link on our website. She was joining us by phone from New York. The next stop is Mona in Hobart.
This week on Poetica, we continue our special on the life and work of the great Australian poet, Kenneth Slessor.
I have lived many lives, and this one life of Joe, long dead, who lives between five bells.
We take a close look at five bells and five visions of Captain Cook.
Cook was a captain of the sailing days when sea captains were kings like this, not cold executives of company rules.
That's Poetica, Saturday at 3, a part of your weekend arts experience.
Yes, right here on RN, and on RN you're listening to Books and Arts Daily with Michael Cathcart. Now, earlier we were talking to the English writer Neil Gaiman about Lewis Carroll and the Alice stories. So come with me now as we step through the looking glass.
Off with the head! Off with the head! Off with the head! How dare you! Off with his head!
Alice Bonham Carter, Helen Bonham Carter, sorry, getting muddled between my characters, as the Red Queen from Tim Burton's film Alice in Wonderland, based on the Lewis Carroll books Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. The Red Queen is the title of the new winter exhibition at Hobart's Museum of Old and New Art, Mona, which is bankrolled and run by professional gambler David Walsh. The museum is taking the character of the Red Queen to explore ideas about art and evolution, and our own Suzanne Donisthorpe is there. She's had a sneak preview or peek at the exhibition. She joins us now. Hi, Suz.
Hi, Michael.
So what's the buzz in Hobart? You're at the opening night of the Red Queen.
Well, Mona, I don't know what it does. There's something about it that really brings people out. It's exciting. It's vibrant. It's spectacular. And people flock to Mona, of course, because it's the best thing in town in terms of culture. It's extraordinary.
So what happened at opening night?
Well, they had free entry for everybody, no matter where they came from, because usually it's only free for people from Tasmania. But all comers got in for nothing, and there was bands, there was a DJ, there was a big fire outside, and of course there was the extraordinary new show with the Red Queen, which opened last night. Much acclaim.
The Red Queen, as seen in the movie, played by Helena Bonham Carter. Not Helen, what am I saying? So tell us about it. What's the Red Queen got to do with anything? How's she tied into this exhibition?
Well, the Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass is slightly tangential. I mean, I don't know if you remember, there's a part where she's with Alice, and Alice is running and running and running, and she doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. And the Red Queen says to Alice, "Well, you come from a very slow country. Here you have to run twice as fast to get half as far." So essentially what they're doing is using that idea and the hypothesis of the Red Queen hypothesis, which is about evolution and how you need to not just keep up or go ahead. You can't necessarily go past evolution because evolution will keep pace with you. So you must continue on. So they've tried to delve into the connection between art and evolution and why on earth people are artists, because that's David Walsh's, the man that runs and owns Mona. He had this premise about, well, why bother with art? What is it in terms of evolutionary selection? Does it make us? What does it make us? What's the point of it? It's expensive. It's often wasteful, and yet people from ancient times to now continue to persist in artistic practice. So why is it? Why is art made? What's it for? In evolutionary terms, and so that's where the Red Queen hypothesis kind of fits in with his ideas.
And are we postulating some answer to that question? What's the evolutionary advantage of being an artist?
Well, David Walsh is a bit of a character, as people may know, and his theory is that the blokes that have got the art get the chicks, pretty much. So his idea is that sexual selection is enhanced by art. But they've taken it into a slightly more serious vein in the exhibition, and they've got nine various chapters within the exhibition that have loosely grouped pieces of art together under these headings. One's data, play, imitation, language, pattern, memory, display, status and belief. And then underneath those sort of nine loose headings, there's groups of artists that they've got to sort of talk about the point that why art happens, because all these things help us to become more evolved people. Like the play element creates a sense of a space to sort of experiment, to figure out what can happen, to imagine, which is also an artistic pursuit.
So, Suzanne, let's talk specifically about two or three of the works. What are we looking at here?
Well, when you walk into Mona, which is the most extraordinary thing to do anyway, because you've got to come down from above through the old the old original building that's still, the bones of it's still there. And then you go down underneath the ground, and the first thing that you see is this amazing piece by Ryoi Akita, who's a Japanese artist who lives in Paris, and his piece is about data. And what it is 10 screens, 10 enormous screens, an enormous screen with black and white patterns. But when you look closely, it's actually data. And he's got data from all over the place, from all sorts of various aspects of life and evolution and how we work and what makes us human, and transpose it into actual code, which then he projects as a sort of moving abstract black and white pattern on this massive screen with this beautiful kind of soundtrack that goes with it. And he's also the artist responsible for the other major thing that's happening in Hobart at the moment, which is Dark Mofo. And he is the man behind the enormous light that people may have heard about on the internet, seen on the papers, the giant 15-metre beam that shines up into the Hobart sky. And it's the most extraordinary thing, and it's also the same artist, Ryoi Akita.
Can you explain what's so extraordinary about it, Suzanne? Because we've all seen searchlights, but the things I'm reading about this suggest that people are very moved by it. What's so special about it?
Well, Michael, it's at the Cenotaph where the Anzac Memorial is. So there's the big, you know, those big Anzac walks that they have in most cities. So
yeah, just 30 seconds, Suze.
And up to, and you get to the top of the hill, and there's 50 lights, and they're enormous. And there's a huge sound system around it. And people flock like moths to these lights. And the lights beam up as far as the eye can see into the night. And as the rain falls, rainbows form, for example. And it is truly transporting. It's a beautiful thing to see.
And just as we wind up, does it feel like international art, or does it address stories that are particular to Hobart or to Tasmania?
Well, I think there's a bit of both in it. I mean, there is a sense of the internationals are there. There's quite a few international artists represented, but there's also a lot of Australian artists. There's been a big attempt to bring in the Tasmanian elements through more of the Dark Mofo stuff with the Vandemonian Lags, which was a band that basically told convict stories. So that was deeply Tasmanian. And also I think the fact that it's the middle of winter and it's freezing cold and we're in Hobart, probably the coldest place in all of Australia, they've brought that Australian elemental spirit of place, I suppose, to the exhibition as well.
Well, it sounds great, Suzanne. So rug up warm and continue to enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Our producer, Suzanne Donisthorpe, speaking to us there from Hobart after the opening of Red Queen, the exhibition at Mona. And if you want to see it, you've got plenty of time because the exhibition is on until April next year. And now on Books and Arts Daily, it's time for Top Shelf. Kate Tempest is a British poet, rapper and playwright, and she's a force to be reckoned with. She started out at 16 rapping to strangers on night buses and pestering MCs in clubs to give her the microphone. And a blend of traditional poetry, energetic hip-hop and a blistering call to arms has really pushed the conventions of performance, so much so that this year she became the first poet under 40 to win the prestigious Ted Hughes Poetry Award. She's also written her first play. It's called Wasted. That's for the new writing theatre company Payne's Plough. For Top Shelf, Kate Tempest shares the works that have changed her life.
Well, a book I'm reading at the moment, which I'm finding really inspiring, is Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections. I might have got those three words the wrong way around, but those three words in some order form the title of this book. It's a memoir that he wrote at the end of his life. It's fascinating, beautifully written. It's kind of conversational and easy to get into, and just really kind of affirming if you're somebody who likes the kind of adventure in the world of the unconscious or the other world. A novel that I really enjoyed was by a man called E.L. Doctorow, and it's called The Book of Daniel. It's an incredible novel. It's like based around the story of the Rosenberg trials in America when, in the 50s, when everybody went crazy about the communists and they killed the couple and the electric chair. This is a kind of fictionalised account of their son, of how he grows up, him and his sister, and his life. And it's this novel, it's him trying to write a novel, and then it kind of flits between perspectives, and we go into the kind of life of his grandmother when she was a child, and it blew my mind to read it. I read it really quickly and was just astonished all the way through. There's another novel that I found really inspiring and fantastic, and it absolutely changed my life when I read it. I read it also recently, is Roberto Bolaño's 2666. I'm not going to say anything about it other than that you should read it. You should read it beginning to end. It will change everything. It's like a whole universe that manages to exist at the same time as the universe that you're in. It's quite remarkable. I find William Blake to be the most incredible human presence, and otherwise I think he's amazing. He lived not that far away from where I live. He saw angels in the trees in Peckinpah Park, which is a park I used to knock about in. Sometimes I walk my dog there and look for those angels, but haven't yet seen them. I read The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, and it changed everything, changed my life. His Proverbs of Hell, they still come back to me now. I think of them all the time. Even sitting here by the harbour, William Blake says, dip him in the river if he loves water. Do you know what I mean? It's serious stuff. He says, you know, you never know what is enough until you know what is more than enough. And I can't help but live my life before the work of William Blake. I once went to see an exhibition of his engravings and paintings, and I literally burst into tears. And I'm not the kind of person that has ever cried at art before, but I was in the gallery and everyone like left the room. But I didn't care, because me and William Blake were having a very intense moment. I think he's wonderful. When the MCs came to live out the names. There's an album that I love by a rapper called GZA. It's called Liquid Swords, and came out over 10 years ago now, but it still stays with me. Like, lyrics will come to me at all hours of the day and night. It keeps unpacking itself on every listen. It changed everything I thought I knew about what a lyric could do. It's like kind of film noir, amazing lyrical record. There's a song by Janis Joplin called Cry Baby, I think it's called, and it's got this like horn riff. You know, people don't use brass the way they used to, right? Brass section, and it's incredible. It's such, I don't know, I've said the word incredible quite a lot of times, but that's kind of how I feel when I meet a piece of artwork. It makes me feel, you know, speechless and awed and closer to something in myself and in the universe. She was amazing. Leonard Cohen wrote about Janis Joplin, you know, you're famous, your heart was a legend. Your heart was a legend. And he was right, you know, like, there is something about her, the music that she makes, but also the kind of integrity of her performance that I find arresting and shocking and all that stuff. In the same way that Nina Simone, Billie Holiday, you know, these, you don't really get it so much anymore, but these women that really have an integrity in their performance, which is a lot about their sexuality, but isn't because of it, you know, isn't like a packaging or a commodification of their femininity. It's like, it's raw, and it could only come from a woman. And as a woman who performs, these women really, really do it for me. I know you got more tears to share, babe. So come on, come on, come on, come on.
Janis, that's an amazing sound. The English performance poet, Kate Tempest, who's pretty incredible herself. On our next show, it's all about fathers and sons. Frank Thring, the larger-than-life Australian actor with a gift for outrageous living, and his equally astounding father, also called Frank Thring. He was a filmmaker, and some people reckon he invented the clapperboard. And also psychotherapist Greg Bellow. He's the son of the great novelist Saul Bellow, and he has lots to say about fathers and sons. Coming up after the news, it's Big Ideas. The American journalist Anne Applebaum questions the term Eastern Europe. Maybe the idea that they are the poor and slightly backward nations of Europe is out of date. But that's all from me. Thank you for spending this hour with me this evening. This is Ari.
Newspapers, radio and TV overwhelm our underpants with fear. But how do we know what fear is the right fear to fear?
Are you ready?
Listen Here.
Hi, I'm comedian Dan Illick, and each Friday night in June, I'll be joined by some of Australia's best comedy brains on Irrational Fear. Here.
What station?
On RN. It's a fast-paced satirical comedy show. Imagine Q&A on crack. It's recorded in front of a live audience. For free tickets, look for Irrational Fear on the RN homepage.